Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the New Hill Country University Center. If you haven't been here after our program today, I would love to take you on a brief tour if we haven't worn you out from the symposium. My name is Julie Martinson. I'm with Texas Tech University. I'd like to thank everyone on behalf of the symposium partners, Texas Tech, Shriner University, Hill Country Alliance, and Texas Public Radio. I'd also like to thank the Hill Country University Foundation for donating the use of this space, the new HEB Activity Center. The Water Symposium is in its fourth year. Tonight is the second program of the 2010-2011 season. The next dates, the third will be on January 27th in San Antonio at the Witt Museum. The fourth and last for this season, The fourth and last will be March 31st at Shriner University in Kerrville. Our program tonight will consist of a one-hour panel with a 30-minute Q&A. Remember, this is a radio program, so if you have questions or comments, you'll need to have a microphone to do so. This program will broadcast with Texas Public Radio, KTXI, in the Hill Country, that's 90.1, and in San Antonio, 89.1. It's my understanding that this particular program will broadcast Friday, November 19th, at 7 o'clock at the Newsmaker Hour. If you would like to refer your friends or you'd like to review our program, my understanding is that it's archived in the Water Symposium website, which is referenced in the back of your program. Tonight, we are privileged to have Carter Smith, the Executive Director with Texas Parks and Wildlife, as our moderator tonight. Inside of our program, you'll see Carter's bio along with our panelists. Again, thank you so much for being here. I want to quickly get off because I'm not the reason why you're here. But enjoy your evening. Please take me up on a tour afterwards. Help yourself to cookies and coffee. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Julie, for that very kind and generous introduction. And certainly let me say on behalf of all of us at Texas Parks and Wildlife how proud we are to be here with you at Texas Tech and our partners at Shriner and Hill Country Alliance and, of course, at Texas Public Radio to talk about a subject that I think is near and dear to all of us as Texans. And I think each and every one of us that is listening to this broadcast tonight can agree that there are so many things that we have in common as Texans, our love for our history, our heritage, our home ground. But if there's anything that unifies us as a state and as a people and a citizenry, it's our water. Its future, its state, its condition, its vitality, its health, its accessibility, its affordability are matters that matter to each and every one of us. And from the lens that I look at the future of that water from a natural resource perspective, there is no doubt that it is absolutely the defining natural resource issue for this state, probably for this country, and certainly for this century and probably the century after that. And as our state's leadership and decision makers struggle with how to find the proverbial balance between all of the competing interests for a finite supply of water, they're grappling with some very fundamental questions. Where's it going to come from? Who's going to get it? And how much are they going to get? And for all of us who care about the future of water and its future for the health of our environment, our natural systems, our outdoor recreation, we're very, very focused on the ramifications of that to our aquatic resources, whether it be our 9 major aquifers, our 200,000 miles of rivers and streams that traverse our state, the springs and seeps that define the Hill Country region, the 15 major river basins in the state, the 7 major bays, the 4 million acres of bay and estuarine habitat that are in receipt of water from places like the Great Texas Hill Country. The implications of the answers to those questions are enormous when we think about their future and how they will continue to function from here on out. Tonight, however, we're going to focus on a specific component related to our water and its future. It's one that doesn't get the attention that it deserves. It has not reached the level of public discourse and consciousness that I think is needed to adequately manage the future of our water supplies. It's something that absolutely deserves more resources and time and attention, and it has to do with the series that we are calling tonight, The Impacts of These Insidious and Stealthy Water Thefts and Water Thieves. We're talking, of course, about exotic and invasive plants and their role in terms of affecting the aquatic communities that we are so concerned about. Invasive species, the term, is a little esoteric in nature. And so what does that term mean? An invasive species can be a plant, could also be an animal. Invasive species are sometimes native species. Most often, they're not. More often than not, they are exotic. They're not found in our state, but they have come and naturalized, usually by the hand of man, either deliberately or accidentally. But they share some fundamentally common properties that cause great consternation to those of us who are concerned about our aquatic resources. They reproduce very quickly. They propagate with abandon. They proliferate. They subsume the environments in which they find. They supplant native fish and wildlife there. They affect water quality. They impede outdoor recreation. Our invasive species are huge and insidious threats to the future of our water, both from a water quality and a water quantity perspective. You know them here in the Hill Country. You know ash juniper that has pervaded the hillsides of the limestone ranges that dominate this area. You know the salt cedar that threatens to take over areas along the Pecos and the Rio Grande. You've heard about hydrilla and hyacinth taking over parts of the Highland Lakes and certainly our water bodies in the eastern part of the state. You may have heard even about some of our newest exotic interlopers in the state, giant salvinia, a rootless fern that came in from Brazil about a dozen years ago and is now found in 17 or 18 water bodies. It can literally double in size in a period of 2 to 3 days and completely take over lakes. Last year, we didn't want it, we didn't need it, and we didn't welcome it. We found zebra mussels in Lake Texoma, a freshwater bivalve or mussel that came in from Russia and points east to the Great Lakes, where it has caused huge amounts of economic and ecological damage. The best scientists always felt that zebra mussels would stay away because Texas was not cool enough, and we were too warm, and zebra mussels would not be able to thrive. And unfortunately, the zebra mussels thought otherwise. And so now we are fighting the good fight to keep them contained in that lake system. Tonight, we've got a body of not only state experts, but national experts that are going to talk to us about the impacts of invasive species and their impacts on the biodiversity of the state. I'm going to talk about the impacts on the economies and water budgets and the future of our water. We're going to have a colleague talk about the role of Texas Parks and Wildlife and what our state agency is doing on your behalf to try to combat the spread of these very pernicious and insidious species. I'm going to start out tonight and introduce a dear old friend, and I say that not just because he hired me at one point for a job, but because he is a dear friend. He's also a proud alumnus of Texas Tech, Dr. Jim Bergen, recently recognized as an outstanding alumnus by the University and the College of Agriculture and Natural Sciences. He's an extraordinary conservation biologist, devoted his entire life to helping to conserve the biodiversity in our great state. He serves now as the Director of Science and Stewardship of the Nature Conservancy, where he has responsibility statewide helping that organization protect some of the state's last great places. And so I'd now like to turn it over to Dr. Jim Bergen. Jim.
Thank you, Carter. I don't know how I always end up seeming like I draw the black bean up. I remember a meeting last year. I gave a talk about the cactus moth down in Kingsville, South Texas Wildlife Conference, and Carter spoke right before I did then, too. You know, and I certainly can't measure up to his oratorial skills here, but I'm going to do my best. And invasive species, what I'm going to talk a little bit about today, we talk about plants. Earl's going to, Dr. Chilton's going to talk probably a little bit more about the plant world. What I want to do is talk a little bit about some bad actors in the vertebrate, invertebrate world, and I'm going to try to run through some of these profiles here and hopefully give you the message that there's things that you can do to help us in terms of abating the threat of invasive species in Texas. I wasn't born in Texas, unfortunately. I was born in Indiana on the shores of Lake Michigan. And when I was a kid growing up, our summers were spent during that narrow window when you could actually get into the waters of Lake Michigan, when it got up to a balmy 55 to 60 degrees, and you'd put your legs in there, and you'd stay there for about an hour, and then you'd go up maybe one more inch in, and then you'd come out, you'd look blue and white, you know, but you'd say that it was awfully refreshing. But one of the perils that I remember when I was little on the shores of Lake Michigan was looking at these huge piles and windrows of dead fish, alewives, is what we called them. And it was just amazing, the biomass and the amount of dead fish that would come along the shores. And alewives I've came to know later as introduced species. It came in through the Erie Canal, through the ocean-going fish, but it just took off in the Great Lakes. Initially, not so much, but because they also introduced a lot of exotic and salmonids, trout and salmon, into Lake Michigan for recreational fishing. They liked alewives. But then the lamprey eel came in, similar to the alewife, and then there went the salmon. So it's just this amazing complex interaction between invasive species and what used to be a very productive fishery overall. I remember accounts of a slick of dead alewives, 40 miles long and 50 miles wide, floating out in the lake. It's amazing. But the bottom line is Lake Michigan was really ground zero in terms of my initial understanding about what invasive species can do and how they can really imperil a natural ecosystem. The mission of the Nature Conservancy is to, Carter, you remember? You can recite this probably. But to preserve the plants, animals, natural communities that represent the diversity of life on Earth by protecting the lands and waters they need to survive. And so, obviously, we're talking about water. And one thing that, you know, I never get tired of stressing is that, observation by E.O. Wilson. Most of you here probably know about Dr. Wilson, preeminent ecologist, and he said that behind habitat destruction, invasive species is the greatest threat to wildlife on Earth. And so that's something we really need to keep in the front of our minds in terms of battling these issues. You know, obviously we could have a whole session on the economic impacts of invasive species. Right now there's really not a good number that really quantifies the overall impact of invasive species on the Texas economy. A dated number, just looking at fire ant impacts from the 90s, is $240 million. You can scale up. I mean, now with Carter said zebra mussels coming in, I mean, the whole list, and Earl will certainly elucidate more on this, but it's incredible when you start trying to even fathom the numbers in terms of impact. And we're not even talking about the natural systems, which is what I want to stress today. So I want to talk a little bit about some bad actors. But before I do start on that, I want to applaud Texas Parks and Wildlife Department in terms of the proactive approaches that they've taken over the last especially the last 4 or 5 years, in terms of abating the threat of invasive species in Texas. Earl's going to talk more about the whitelisting process, but there's some very progressive thinking on the part of the Texas Parks and Wildlife under Earl and Carter, all their colleagues' leadership in the department. I just want to take this opportunity to thank you and thank your department for doing that. So as we already talked about zebra mussels, I'm going to just kind of give a snapshot about the zebra mussels. And again, being originally from the Lake Michigan area, that's where zebra mussels first appeared. And I remember distinctly my brother Joe was in the scuba diving business and salvage diving business up on Lake Michigan. And believe me, you need a wetsuit if you're going to do that, okay? But one of the, you know, I remember him calling me up back in about 1990 and saying, "Jim, you're not going to believe it. I've got the phone ringing off the wall." I said, "What's going on?" He goes, I got more work than I can know what to do with." I said, "Tell me about it." He said, "I'm working for all the a water municipality, also a steel mill that has discharge pipes going out in Lake Michigan, and I'm constantly out there clearing these things called zebra mussels off the pipes and the intakes." He said, "It's good money." And I said, "That doesn't sound so good to me, but I said, I'm glad you're happy." But anyways, that was, you know, the zebra mussel came into the Great Lakes in 1988, so I've been here in the United States for 22 years. And fortunately now it's in 29 states, and as Carter alluded to, it's here in Texas now, unfortunately. In fact, this year, 2010, it showed up for the first time in California. And you know how Texans think about California. We always want to compete with them, but we don't really want to win this one with them. But anyhow, as the name infers, you know, when Tom told me that we didn't have our PowerPoint projection, it kind of put us into a tailspin. So just work with me on description of zebra mussels. Well, let me take a hand. I mean, how many of you have actually seen a zebra mussel? Gary, you can't raise your hand. But it's D-shaped, and it's a big one is probably about 2 inches. And generally, they do have stripes, but not always. They can be variations. And so getting this information out, which Parks and Wildlife has done a great job of, is really the key component of early detection. And, in fact, that's how, correct me if I'm wrong, fellows, but that's how the Lake Texoma occurrence was found, as a report from the public. Somebody called in, "I think we've got something here," and sure enough, it was. The zebra mussel can filter up to 1 quart of water per day. A female can produce 1 million eggs every year. They can live up to 5 years. Generally, in the United States, they don't quite have that lengthy of a lifespan. But when you think about how problematic zebra mussels can be, you can look at images of native crayfish with zebra mussels encrusted all over their carapace. Picture native mussels, of which Texas has very rare endangered suite or guild of endangered mussels. Picture zebra mussels just totally coating these native mussels. That's going to be a hard battle for them to win. And so, in terms of Trinity River Valley, you've got mussels such as the Texas heel splitter, the Texas pigtoe, the rock pocketbook, fawn's foot. You know, I've always thought Dr. Seuss must have been involved in naming many of our native mussels, because those are just great. And so they're barely clinging on right now. You overlay zebra mussels into the equation, and, it's really scary and a daunting issue. Zebra mussels are assisted in their movements by everything from boats, boat trailers, the Great Lakes anchor chains, ballast water, and possibly birds, ducks, and that's kind of my interest, waterfowl, wetland ecology. Ducks love them. Lesser scaup have been documented to eat them constantly. They sort of eat them, eat zebra mussels like I would be eating peanuts watching Monday Night Football. But they can't keep up. They can't keep up with the growth rate of zebra mussels. Zebra mussels can grow in very dense clusters, up to 100,000 zebra mussels per square meter. When they coat a beach, you can't walk on the beach anymore without boots or some kind of protective. They'll shred the bottom of your feet. Fortunately for Texas, zebra mussels don't do well in high-flowing rivers and streams. But at the same time, unfortunately for Texas, a lot of our rivers are already over-allocated in terms of their water. And so some of those flows aren't quite what they ought to be or what they used to be. And so that is a cause for concern in terms of the spread of zebra mussels throughout the state. The issue between allocation of water and zebra mussels is one that can't not be underestimated. You know, in fact, the main theory working and how we got it in the first place is through an interbasin transfer of water, which is obviously a component of a statewide water plan. And so there can be more pressure over time to do more interbasin transfers of water. So anyways, that's the snapshot on zebra mussels. And we certainly hope that, I think, with the department's leadership, and if you go to the Texas Parks and Wildlife website, you're going to find just a wealth of information about zebra mussels and their status in the state. The next bad actor I want to talk about is actually one that Dr. Gary Garrett ought to be up here and talking about, and that is the armored catfish. Actually, it's a guild. Armored catfish or sucker-mouth catfish. You can group them together. There's actually over 600 species in this group of armored catfish. They originate from the Amazon Basin, and they're in Texas. They've been in Texas for a good while. Actually, the first introduction was recorded in 1962. They're certainly favorites of the aquarium trade, and but they have been shown to have impacts in wild situations. And for example, in Puerto Rico, there's been documentation of brown pelicans dying because they're trying to swallow these armored catfish and they can't navigate them. They're not used to that. I found it interesting in Florida, although they haven't found any real impacts, our suckermouth catfish will feed off of the backs of manatees and their epibiota on the skin, the algae and plankton that sticks. So some incredible relationship there, although not known whether that's really a negative impact. As I said, the suckermouth catfish is favorite of the aquarium trade. People like them because they keep the inside of the aquarium clean. I had them when I was a kid in my aquarium, and that's okay. The issue and the trouble comes up is when Johnny goes off to school and mom and dad have to deal with the aquarium back at home, and they get tired of having to deal with it. Dad usually ignores the whole situation. Mom is stuck having to deal with it, and she doesn't have the heart to kill the or euthanize the fish that are remaining there. She tries to figure out a way to give them to somebody. Nobody wants them. And she gets an idea. Let me go ahead and dump it in the headwaters of San Antonio River. Maybe that would be a good idea. I can let them go free. You know, and you can hear the Born Free music going in the background. Well, when you repeat that in the San Jacinto Trinity Basin, you repeat it in the San Felipe Springs area, you know, you can certainly say, Houston, we do have a problem, and we do. These are very tough fish. They're very amazing fish. And actually, in terms of understanding the taxonomy of this group, they're still these fish are still being discovered. Just, Gary, this year, there was a new species of armored catfish discovered in the Amazon Basin called a wood-eating catfish. I mean, these are tough fish. They eat wood, okay? So they also can survive for long periods of time without water. They can actually gulp air. They burrow into riverbanks, so they can cause structural issues, and they're very aggressive. And also they impact the algae and the planktonic communities in the aquatic habitats where they live. We don't really know that much about overall impacts. One thing we do know is in the San Felipe Springs, where we have a very endangered Devil's River minnow, The minnow numbers have certainly been in decline since the suckermouth catfish have expanded in terms of great numbers and overall biomass. So when you start thinking about impacts of suckermouth catfish in headwater areas, you know, where you could have impact on blind salamanders, comal, camal, riffle beetles, speckled chubs, Kegel's map turtles, on and on, these endemic species that don't live anywhere else in the world, it's an area of concern and one that we really need to look at hard. Again, referring back to Dr. E.O. Wilson, he called the Edwards Plateau the 26th hotspot in the world for biodiversity. And if we lose some of these endemic species in these springhead systems due to invasive species, then it's going to be a horrible, horrible event. We need to find out more. There's actually, I just looked at a proposal a couple weeks ago about it from a postdoc that wants to look at this specific issue, a young woman from Cornell University. So hopefully if that gets funded, we can start looking at it in greater detail in terms of impacts of armored catfish and on native species. The next one I want to talk about, my time is running out here too, right? So I'm going to briefly cover this one, because it's a very interesting species called the channeled apple snail. And the channeled apple snail has been in Texas for a while. We have occurrences in down in the Houston area and also in several other coastal counties. This is a large snail. And Texas doesn't have any large snails that will, you know, basically be the size of a grown man's fist. So this is a really obvious invader. They have different colorations. The most popular ones are gold. Again, a favorite selection in the aquarium trade. And one that, as of right now, doesn't seem to be a major problem. However, it could be. Bob Howells, formerly with Texas Parks and Wildlife, and still working on mollusk and snails and other aquatic species in Texas, has posed the theory that they could impact native mollusk. We just don't know yet. And if they get into some of these real hot spots, as I've referred to, San Marcos Springs, Comal Springs, they could really, really make an impact. And so that's another bad actor that we really need to keep an eye on. If you ever see one, please contact your local Texas Parks and Wildlife biologist and so that they can verify or refute what you found. And hopefully we can keep them at bay. I'm just going to close out by saying that I don't think a week or a month goes by without some email alert that we get about another invasive species coming in the state of Texas. This is a problem. It's bigger than Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. It's bigger than the Fish and Wildlife Service. It's bigger than any agency. This is one, as Carter alluded to, this is a clarion call to action. I mean, we have to give this the focus it needs. We can't accept status quo. We can't accept people saying, we're not worried about it. I live in downtown Houston. Why do I care about that? Well, they need to care about it because it imperils the ecosystem factories that we have throughout the state of Texas. And, you know, for example, just a couple weeks in late October, I get a report from our research botanist, Bill Carr, saying he's down at our Madeline Marsh Preserve, Matagorda County. He said, Jim, we got a new one down here, a species called water snowflake, Nymphoides indica. And it's all over one of our moist soil units down there that we enhance for waterfowl use. Like, what is going on now? So here we have another battle on top of all the other ones. So, again, diligence, early detection is the key to combating invasive species throughout Texas. I just want to close with a quote from one of our former CEOs of the Nature Conservancy, John Sawhill, and that is, in the end, our society will be judged not only by what we create, but what we refuse to destroy. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, for that excellent presentation. I think there were some key points there that are really worth repeating. And, you know, first and foremost, I think in Dr. Bergen's presentation is there's a lot at stake in the Texas Hill Country. The biological diversity here is absolutely extraordinary. It's almost singularly unparalleled. And so complacency is not an option for us as we think about the potential impact of these exotic and invasive species. And I think another point that Dr. Bergen made that, again, bears repeating is that we think about our world as much more interconnected than it ever has been. It's much easier for these organisms to be transported from lake to lake and river to river and country to country, most oftentimes unwittingly. But with that said, the absolute best approach to addressing that is a proactive one, as Jim said, a preemptive one. It's an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And I think that's a good segue into our next presenter tonight, Dr. Earl Chilton. Dr. Chilton is a nationally, if not internationally, recognized expert on combating invasive and exotic species. He is the director of our Aquatic Habitat Enhancement Program at Texas Parks and Wildlife and in charge of our Aquatic Vegetation Management Programs. He serves on many national and state councils dealing with invasive species, including serving as the vice chair of the Texas Invasive Species Coordinating Council. Dr. Chilton has been on the front lines every day dealing with the spread and proliferation of these species that are threatening our aquatic systems. Please help me in welcoming Dr. Earl Chilton. Earl.
Well, as you probably surmised, there's a lot to say about this subject, but the moderator is my boss, so I'm going to try to be on time. What I'd like to do is first give you an introduction to the mission of TPWD, to also introduce you to some of the problems created by some of the aquatic invasive species we see in the state, and then I'd like to explain the evolution of some of the new regulations that will be put in place next year. The mission, the TPWD mission, is to manage and conserve the natural and cultural resources of Texas and to provide hunting and fishing and outdoor recreational opportunities for the use and enjoyment of present and future generations. Unfortunately, invasive species can often negatively affect both the natural and the cultural resources of the state. I'd like to give you just a few examples of that. Dr. Bergen certainly addressed zebra mussels in detail, but I would just like to mention, too, that as they colonize underwater structures like bridges and pilings and so forth, one of the things they tend to do is change the pH close to that structure. So they actually accelerate corrosion of both metal and structures and rotting of wood structures at the same time. So that's one way that they negatively impact our cultural resources by accelerating the destruction of our bridges and underwater structures. Also, I would like to mention for zebra mussels that we find zebra mussels not only in Lake Texoma but in Sister Grove Creek. They were actually pumped into there, and it's one of the only flowing water systems in the country that we're trying to initiate an eradication program in. So that people around the country, from the Western Regional Panel to the East Coast, are interested in what we're doing in Texas and really want to know whether or not that program is going to work, if we're actually going to be able to eradicate them from a flowing water system. Well, there are a number of other plants that I'm going to be speaking mostly about that can negatively impact our natural resources. One is giant salvinia. Giant salvinia, as Carter mentioned, as Mr. Smith mentioned, is a floating fern. But he didn't mention that it can become so thick on the water that it prevents oxygen exchange. In some cases, we've seen giant salvinia growing a meter thick on the water. Obviously, oxygen can't get down to the fish when you have a situation like that. Obviously, when you have a giant salvinia growing like that, it's going to affect fishing. It's going to affect boating. You're not going to be able to swim in it, and you're not going to be able to get to your favorite hunting place either. An example of how fast it grows is we found just a few areas with giant salvinia on Caddo Lake. A couple of years later, there were over 3,000 acres of it on Cattle Lake, despite the fact that we were trying to treat it. It can really grow fast and get out of hand quickly. Another one that we are concerned about in Texas is water hyacinth. I know probably most of you have seen water hyacinth. It's a floating plant, another floating plant. Sometimes it can grow 3 to 4 feet off the water surface. Obviously, if you get thick water hyacinth, it's going to affect boating and swimming as well. But a particularly horrible case happened a few years ago when we had particularly bad water hyacinth infestation on the Rio Grande. There were areas of the Rio Grande that literally you could drive for miles without seeing any water because the river was completely covered with water hyacinth. Not only was there water hyacinth there, but there was another invasive species that colonized the river as well as hydrilla. The combination of those two actually stopped the water from getting to the Gulf. I have aerial photos of the Rio Grande stopping in a sandbar just short of the ocean. So these things can really affect ecosystems. Mr. Smith talked about water loss and the issues with water as well. One of the things we need to be concerned about with water hyacinth is that there is some evidence that water hyacinth, the very presence of water hyacinth on the water, can accelerate water loss due to evaporation. Typically, sometimes 2 to 3 times as much water is lost when you have water hyacinth on there on a water body. In some cases, up to 13 times as much water is lost if water hyacinth is present and covering a water body. We also have golden algae in the state. Many of you may be familiar with golden algae and the fish kills that are caused by golden algae. But golden algae may not be the only algae we need to be concerned with. In some cases, other infestations of algae are not only toxic, but affect the taste and the quality of water as well. Well, I've been asked to speak primarily about plants, so the next thing I'd like to do is give you just a brief overview of what our regulations are like and what the new regulations are going to be like. Under current regulations, the department has authority to restrict the possession of harmful or potentially harmful aquatic plants. We can issue permits if it's really necessary that you possess that permit that plant, but we have a list of about 20 plants that are currently prohibited in the state. The disadvantages of this system are that in order to go on this list, the plants have to go before our commission. It's actually a regulation that can take sometimes 3, 6, or 9 months. Depending on how long the commission wants to consider the issue, depending on how the availability of information relative to the plants we're trying to put on the list. So by the time we get a plant on the list, in some cases it could have already been established and causing problems before we can make it illegal. A good example of that would have been giant salvinia. As Mr. Smith indicated, it doubles about once a week, sometimes less, and if we had to wait 9 months or 6 months or 9 months to get it on the list, we would have been in very deep trouble by now. Well, consequently, during the last legislative session, TPWD was directed to publish a list of exotic aquatic plants that are approved for use in Texas rather than a prohibited list. We were directed that we should be as permissive as possible without allowing plants that pose an environmental risk, a human health risk, or an environmental risk to the state. Initially, these rules were to be in place this coming January 1st. We were given a little bit of a reprieve about a month ago from the legislature and allowed to go a little bit further with that. But nevertheless, we're going to present draft rules to our commission in January for consideration. Well, how are these rules being developed? The first thing we need to do is contact industry personnel, people in the nursery industry, people in the aquarium trade, people that are dealing with these plants, to find out what plants are actually being bought and sold in Texas. And we asked people to give us a list of plants they thought should be legal in the state. We received about 500 plant species. Legitimate plant species. Actually, we probably received about 2,000, but a lot of the names we received were incorrect. So far, we have actually evaluated about 500 plant species, and these species are going to be published in the Texas Register in the middle of December. So the public will have access to look at what plants are on this approved list and comment. As we went through this process, and by the way, anything that's not on that approved list will be illegal in the state once these rules are in place. We will give ourselves the authority to issue a permit in some cases, and I'll talk a little bit more about permits later. But as we went through this process, a question came up: what is a plant? Well, we determined that anything within the kingdom Plantae is a plant. That's common sense, right? Well, there are numerous systems, taxonomic systems available out there. There's a two-kingdom system, a three-kingdom system, all the way up to a ten-kingdom system. What we chose was to go with the integrated taxonomic information system that's backed by numerous federal agencies here in the U.S., as well as federal agencies in Canada, federal agencies in Mexico, and the Smithsonian Institution, as well as some other nonprofit organizations. We felt that there was enough clout there that we could reasonably defend that. Well, under this system, a lot of organisms that would normally fall into another kingdom, that would normally fall in the kingdom called Protista, are included. Well, why is that important? Because a lot of these that may not have been included before are now included are microalgae. Then the question arises: well, why would you even think about regulating microalgae? They're just little green balls, right? Well, there's been escalating interest in the use of biofuels lately, and microalgae are some of the chief species that industry would like to use. In some cases, it looks like we may be able to get a yield sometimes 20 times greater than we can get from corn or some of the other species that they've been looking at. We found that there are so many species and strains of microalgae that we have to treat them differently than we would treat the vascular plants, the normal things you would normally think of as plants, particularly because there are toxicity issues associated with some of these microalgae. And I know a lot of you are probably familiar with red tide. Those sorts of issues are associated with algae. So we want to be careful about which algae are allowed in the state, especially on a mass production basis. Well, under the draft regulations, no permit would be needed for possession and use of species that are known to be native, that have been naturalized in Texas, or that are known to be of low risk in Texas waters. Additionally, what we're proposing is that if you're a professor or researcher or a museum, you'd be allowed to possess these things without a permit, too, for educational purposes. When would a permit be required? Well, it would be required if you were going to possess a microalgae that is toxic, or if you were going to possess a microalgae that and haven't provided us with information about the species and the strain of the algae that you're going to use. If we don't know exactly what the species is, then we'll have to treat it as an exotic algae, one that we're not sure about. And certainly if we're dealing with a genetically modified organism, if it's had a gene inserted into it, it makes it a new organism. It's obviously not native, so it will be treated as an exotic plant. There would be permits for research, for aquaculture, for aquatic vegetation management, for watershed treatment, and for industrial or commercial uses, including biofuel production. And as I said before, we're planning to present these new regulations to our commission in January. If you have any additional information, if you need any additional information, please visit our website. Now, in terms of outreach, which is the other thing I was asked to talk about, one of the things TPWD is doing to develop is the development of major outreach programs. The first major outreach program that we developed was kicked off last April. It was a giant salvinia campaign. During that campaign, at the kickoff event in downtown Austin, Governor Perry was actually there. He seemed to be very concerned about invasive species, and I think that was a big boost for the campaign. The strategy was to get information out there on the ground, in broadcast, in print, online, on our vehicles, and so forth. We had on-the-ground signage in place. We have buoys in some of the target reservoirs that have Giant Salvinia on the buoy. We have metal signs around some of the worst-hit reservoirs with Giant Salvinia on there. We have pump toppers. Have you seen those advertisements above gasoline pumps? Usually for sandwiches and hot dogs and things. But we have ones there that are telling you to be careful about Giant Salvinia. We had information at the Texas Toyota Bass Classic on Lake Conroe this year, which is one of the largest bass tournament events in the country. We have a website. We had TV ads. One of the TV ads included a fellow that played the Giant Salvinia monster. I you could probably go on YouTube and see this. It's pretty good. So I encourage you to do a search for that. We also had brochures and free material that we were handing out at particular events. The next planned campaign is for zebra mussels. And you've heard a lot about zebra mussels today, so I won't go into all of that. But hopefully during that campaign we'll have website availability and posters and the same sort of things we had for the Giant Salvinia campaign. Now, in order to address some of these issues, we've also been working with other state agencies. Mr. Smith mentioned the Texas Invasive Species Coordinating Committee. I'm currently the vice chair. That is composed of six state agencies, as well as an advisory group composed of industry, federal agencies, and NGOs. The main thrust, the main objectives for this group are first to facilitate information exchange among state agencies so that the state agencies know what they're doing relative to these issues. And the second objective is to really to try to obtain federal money. There's federal money out there for invasive species control, and if we can couple that with state money for invasive species control, we think we can do a much better job. Currently, we're utilizing both state money and federal money to try to control these things. Typically, we use biological controls, pesticides, drawdowns, and in some cases, mechanical harvest to try to keep invasive plants under control. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Chilton. Obviously, the subject of invasive species is a complicated one. It involves a multiple array of tools to help combat it, and certainly not the least of which is the proactive education and outreach and helping us all take responsibility and have accountability for what we can do to help arrest the spread of these invasive and exotic species. We now want to talk about invasive species and their impacts on water. Water loss, water budgets, and also the economic consequences of invasive species. And we've got a great partner to talk about that tonight, Dr. Tom Arsufi. He may reside and have office at the state's absolute best location in the world there along the Llano River at the Texas Tech Field Station. Dr. Tom Arsufi is no stranger to aquatic ecology, a former professor there at Texas State before he became of sound mind and body and came to Texas Tech, where he is today. He's an expert on riverine and stream ecology, among many things, and including invasive and exotic species. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Tom Arsufi. Tom.
Thank you, Carter. I get to take credit for the title of tonight's symposium. And it's one of the shortest titles I've come up with in recent years. So I want you to take a look at it, and I want to go over the title a little bit because I put some thought into it. Insidious and stealthy. Well, what's insidious? One of the definitions in the dictionary is awaiting a chance to entrap, treacherous, harmful but enticing, seductive, having a gradual and cumulative effect, subtle. And relating to disease, I thought this fit invasive species very well. Developing so gradually as to be well established before becoming apparent. Stealthy, slow, deliberate, and secret in action or character. Intended to escape observation. I think those two words describe the state of invasive species in Texas and the nation and the world to this day. Now, I'm an aquatic ecologist, and I've given lots of talks about invasive species, endangered species, ecology, rivers, and those kinds of things. And I can tell you about the value of preserving biodiversity and ecosystem impacts and community disruptions and those things. But I've discovered in the past that the general public doesn't really have as much an appreciation for those types of arguments as us scientists do. And I figured out a long time ago that one of the ways to make that biodiversity argument more relevant is to put a dollar sign associated with it. So what I did through the years in some of my various works with invasive species, I went back and looked at what were some of the economic implications of the particular invasive species that I have done research on over the years. So, economics. There are some articles in the literature about the economic impacts of invasive species. David Pimentel is one of the authors that have done a lot of look into this. He writes, invasive species cause more extinction of native species than most any other threats and cause more than $120 billion in damages and control costs each year. That's just for the United States. This afternoon, before coming here, I wanted to see how much invasive species was in the newspapers. So I went to this site that catalogs invasive species stories around the world. In just the past week, 30 stories about invasive species of all kinds of types have appeared in newspapers around the world. Here's one that was published October 22nd, 2010. I'm going to read you a couple of the findings of this study that came out of the Global Invasive Species Program. The estimated damage from invasive species worldwide totals more than $1.4 trillion annually. 5% of the global economy goes down the tubes because of invasive species. Individually, climate change and invasive species present two of the greatest threats to biodiversity and the provision of valuable ecosystem services, says the report. One of my first entries to invasive species was when I got into Texas in 1989. I was in San Marcos, and the director of Parks and Recreation for the city of New Braunfels came up to Texas, Southwest Texas, and he said, well, I've got a problem. I don't know if you've been to New Braunfels and seen Land O'Lake, but his problem was that they were having to take dump truck loads of floating aquatic vegetation out of Land O'Lake every week. And he'd never had to do that before. And he wanted me to come down there and take a look and see what was the source. And he thought that there was this funny little snail down there that he hadn't seen there before. So I went down there and found out that it was the giant ram's horn snail, an invasive species that's different than most snails in that it actually consumes, like grasshoppers, live vegetation. And since they don't have arms and hands and they can't manipulate things, when they bite off a chunk of vegetation, sometimes they're not able to consume it. Floating vegetation has air tissues in it, floats to the surface, and there was the cause. So I started studying that invasive species. Right about that time in 91, we started to suffer a severe drought. There's endangered species in the springs. A lawsuit was filed. There was a court hearing in district court associated with maintaining spring flows for Comal and San Marcos Springs, and the judge ruled in favor of the lawsuit and told Fish and Wildlife Service they had to establish take and jeopardy levels. And the next thing you know, I'm getting a call from the court monitor about this giant ram's horn snail. And I didn't understand what was the implications. Well, part of the implication is because this invasive species was having an impact on the endangered species. So the ruling was that with the ram's horn snail being an issue, flows had to be maintained at 200 cubic feet per second versus 150 cubic feet per second if they were not a problem. Well, I went down and got a calculator, and 50 cubic feet per second, what does that amount to over a year? 36,500 acre feet of water. If you put a cost, and I, you know, and you can get various costs, but I took $500 an acre foot. That amounts to $18 million a year because of this one invasive species that's not very widespread, but it's in those spring systems. So, impact. Earl mentioned the Rio Grande stopped flowing in 2001 because there wasn't enough water. Part of it was because of drought, but a lot of it was because of a weed infestation with hydrilla and water hyacinth. Increasing evapotranspiration, restricting the canals, water loss through bank absorption, and other factors. Costs associated with that weed infestation of the Rio Grande was roughly $1 million for that short period of time. Also, and this was not part of that, through vast stretches of the Rio Grande is another invasive species called giant reed, Arundo. Arundo is also purported to use more water through evapotranspiration than native species. A study on the Santa Ana River in Southern California, which is California's largest river, it's about a 686,000 hectare watershed, only has about 4,000 hectares of Arundo, this giant reed, on it. Yet, the water loss to the Arundo in this watershed is about 30,000 acre feet of water a year. We've got a lot more Arundo on the Rio Grande. What they calculated was that elimination of Arundo would save $12 million annually. $12 million annually. One watershed, just one watershed. Texas. We've got water issues coming up. We got water issues now. They're going to get worse. By 2060, we're going to go from right now roughly 25 million people to close to 50 million people. Our water consumption is going to increase. Where are we going to get more water? Water doesn't grow on trees. You can't technologically develop water. Well, the Water Development Board has a plan. And they have a bunch of strategies for increasing water for Texas. They've got demand-based strategies like water conservation, waste prevention, cancellation of water rights, water transactions and banking. They have non-traditional supply strategies like conjunctive use of groundwater and surface water, brush control. We, you know, John Brox will tell you, we got tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of acres of mesquite and cedar in much of Texas. Interbasin transfers, desalinization, weather modification, rainwater catchment and gray water systems. You know what's not in the Texas Water Development Board plan for increasing water supply in Texas? Invasive species. Invasive species consumed inordinate amounts of water. And we don't really know how much, but I want to take you through a little exercise. Earl and Jim have mentioned giant salvinia in Texas, a recent colonist of Texas. But we've had water hyacinth around for a long, long time. Water hyacinth is known at one time as one of the dirty dozen, one of the worst invasive species on the planet Earth. It's considered the world's worst aquatic weed. Costs billions of dollars in control cost. Florida has a line item in their state budget of about $15 million just for water hyacinth, one invasive species. It disrupts the lives of millions of people, contributes to water losses and evapotranspiration. So what about Texas and water hyacinth? Texas, we have roughly, in terms of our major reservoirs, 1 million acres of surface area in terms of our reservoirs. 1 million acres. Most of you guys have been to a lake and you walk around the edges and you see these little floating plants covering the surface, especially in the shallow, calmer areas. What if 5% of the surface area, that 1 million acres, was water hyacinth? Earl told you water hyacinth evapotranspirates 3 to 8 times as much water as open water. Well, we know that evaporation for just open water is 9 gallons of water a day per acre. So let's be conservative about water hyacinth. Let's just say it takes 3 times instead of 8 times the above. That amounts to 30 acre feet of water a year if it's covered with water hyacinth. 30 acre feet of water a year, 5% of the surface area is covered in water hyacinth. That amounts to 1.5 million acre feet of water that's lost, consumed by water hyacinth, that leaves the lake. That amounts to $750 million a year with an invasive species in terms of just water loss. And I don't think 5% surface area coverage is all that much. So that is a big issue. Now, I found this in the literature, and I thought this was interesting. The country South Africa, they have a program, a brand new program. I think it's been in existence 2 or 3 years. It's called Working for Water. And it's a public service initiative. And they have considered that invasive species is one of their biggest water thieves. That the best they can do with developing more water for South Africa is to control invasive species. A quote, more and more the complementary factor in short supply, limiting factor, is the remaining natural capital, not man-made capital, as it used to be. For example, it's populations of fish, not fishing boats, that limit the catch of fish worldwide. So, economic logic says to invest in the limiting factor. That's what economy says. If you got a limiting factor, you invest in the limiting factor. It's changing nowadays. It used to be technology that was the limiting factor. Boats. So we get more boats, we can get out and catch more fish. Now that's switching. Now it's the fish that we have to worry about. We can get enough boats out there. So the logic has not changed, but the identity of the limiting factor has. And so what South Africa has done is a national program for South Africa that the best way that they can get more water is through controlling invasive species, because the best sites for reservoirs have already been used up. Kind of sounds like Texas, doesn't it? All the rivers have pretty much been allocated. Kind of sounds like Texas. So I think invasive species is something that Texas can do a much better job of factoring in terms of increasing our water supply. And I'd make the argument that exotic species management is a water conservation strategy. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Arsufi. I think Tom did a great job of rounding out the evening and really bringing home to all of us what the very serious economic consequences of invasive and exotic species are, and highlighted just how relevant this problem is to each and every one of us and what we stand to lose with the continued proliferation of these invasive species throughout our state's water bodies. To all of our listeners tonight, I hope our program has been informative. I hope it has helped elevate your awareness of not only the gravity of this situation, but also the real and serious consequences of inaction. We've got a lot at stake. In the Texas Hill Country, we have always been defined for our springs, our streams, our rivers, our creeks, our extraordinary aquatic resources, and we absolutely cannot afford to see them lose their special place in our minds, our hearts, and on our landscapes to the threat of these species. Anything we can do to arrest their spread is an action worth taking. Let's give all of our presenters a big round of applause tonight. We want to open it up to questions to our audience that is with us tonight. And for the benefit of our radio audience, I'm going to ask each of you who has a question to stand up. I will repeat your question so we capture it in the microphones, and then I will direct that to the appropriate presenter. I'll start off with the first question of the evening. Gentlemen, all of you presented a very bleak picture of invasive species. You painted a picture of problems with biodiversity. You painted a picture of the difficulty of trying to arrest the spread of these invasive species once they get started. You painted a picture of the huge problems they pose to our economies and the future of our water. But to the average citizen, what does that mean? And what is the advice that each and every one of you would give our average listener about what he or she could do to help address this problem? Who wants to start off?
Yeah, Carter. I mean, what I would offer up just initially is, as I alluded to, is education outreach, and that's where I've seen really some great strides in the last 2 to 3 years by Texas Parks and Wildlife Department in terms of really energizing efforts to get the word out, not just to the rural population. A lot of folks in the rural areas of Texas, they get it a little bit more readily in terms of impacts of invasive species. It's the urban population centers that really need more awareness to understand, kind of going back to Tom's comment, put it down into dollars and cents, but also for the kids to that we need to integrate this aspect into overall conservation education programs, in my opinion. And because these are the future voters. And just one last point. When I worked in Florida, and Tom alluded to some big numbers just for controlling water hyacinth, I was hired as a waterfowl biologist on Lake Okeechobee. But I'll tell you, 50% of my job was involved invasive aquatic plant management planning. And there was a lot of big money that went into controlling invasive plants. On one hand, you say, wow, it's an unending battle. And to a degree, you're right, it is. But that the state showed a real commitment to understanding this is a huge problem, and we got to put some investment into controlling it. And I think over time, seeing some encouraging signs from the state of Texas that we're starting to head down that road where we're going to see a real commitment to addressing the issue.
Yeah, the way I would look at this is we've got a lot of stakeholders with regard to invasive species. And one of the big sources, and that's one of the things we didn't really get into, is where do invasive species comes from? Where do they come from? How do they get into Texas? How do they get in the United States? Well, Jim was talking about, around Lake Erie and in the Great Lakes. You know, that's ballast water. That's from shipping channels and so forth. But in Texas, a major source for invasive species, is the pet trade industry, the aquarium industry, the water garden industry, aquaculture, and I think educating some of those stakeholders about what is it at issue with regard to invasive species is one of the components that we need to look at. One of the words, one of my famous words that I really like is proactive. And proactive is one of those terms that you're getting out ahead of something. You're anticipating the problem. And most of the studies that have been done on economic impacts of invasive species is the cost of control is so much lower if you get them early, if you get ahead of the curve. It's so much more expensive once the cat's out of the barn to control them, much, much more. Studies I've seen are 25 to 100 times the cost increase is if you're reactive as opposed to proactive. So I would like to see, a much stronger multi-agency initiative. I mean, Texas Department of Agriculture. I mean, we got invasive species, hitting all of the different types of agencies that all have a role to play. And I think the Invasive Coordinating Committee, which Earl is a vice chair, is a really, really promising approach that can get ahead of the curve and be proactive.
In terms of a practical approach to being proactive, there are several things that I would recommend. The first would be to be cognizant of what's going on, to pay attention, because often we're able to stop these infestations, particularly of plants, if we know about them. So if a person sees an unusual species somewhere, sees a new plant they haven't seen before floating around or growing in the water, report it to Parks and Wildlife Department, report it to a biologist so we can go out, possibly identify it, and hopefully do something about it if it is an invasive species. The other thing is to pay attention to what we're doing. There's evidence that simply by wearing waders with felt bottoms, it's possible to transport invasive species from one water body to another. So there's evidence that some plants have been transferred from reservoir to reservoir because people have failed to clean their boat motors off or their trailers off. I've got pictures of boat ramps with giant salvinia trailing down the down the highway because people haven't cleaned their boats off. And also, when we have plants and animals that are in aquaria, be mindful that those, a lot of times those plants and animals aren't native to Texas. And even though we want to be like Jacques Cousteau and say, go in peace, don't do that. Don't let them go. But send them back to the aquarium shop. Or euthanize them, because that will be much better for the state. In terms of our own, and keep in mind also that in terms of our own pocketbook, these things can save you money. One fellow asked me several years ago, why should I be concerned about hydrilla growing in Lake Austin or Travis, Lake Travis? I don't care about that. It's just a weed in the water. And I told him, let's put it this way. If that plant grows to a certain level and then it breaks off, floats downstream, clogs up the generators go down, that costs money, your electric bill will go up. Then he understood he was going to watch for the weed.
Any questions out there for the audience? Let's start with the lady in the middle, and then we'll come to the gentleman in the front. Great question, and I'm going to repeat that again just for the listeners on the radio in terms of is there a hotline available for people to report when they see an exotic and invasive species? And I know that Dr. Chilton can handle that. So, Earl?
There is a hotline number. In fact, there's a national hotline number, but unfortunately I don't remember it. but we can find out for you afterwards and give you that number.
We do accept calls through our Operation Game Thief line, which is 1-800-792-GAME, G-A-M-E. That's also a line that you can report any fish or wildlife violation, environmental crime, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, anonymously. And once we get those calls, we'll either farm it out to a biologist or a game warden as appropriate. So 1-800-792-GAME, G-A-M-E. In the front row. So I think the question is, with respect to the water symposium this evening, is it affiliated with the Hill Country Alliance?
Yes.
Yes, the Hill Country Alliance is a sponsor of tonight's event. Okay, let me start in the back, and then I'll come up to the front. Yes, sir, in green.
Shriner University. I really liked a lot of the points that got brought up tonight, especially the proactive educational approach. Dr. Arsufi pointed out that apart from exotic species, one of our big challenges is climate change. And unfortunately, those things are not mutually exclusive. How can we be proactive in the face of a changing climate where certain habitats are becoming favorable for exotics that hadn't been before?
I want to ask each of y'all to address that.
Well, you bring up an excellent point, and certainly we're already seeing some expansion of certain invasive species, especially warm season grasses, for example, in South Texas. A lot of folks, and I think the data are starting to bear up the fact that expansion of grasses such as buffle grass and carob blue stem, et cetera, is being certainly assisted by climate change. We're already seeing, I mean, it's not something in the future. We're already seeing some of these things now. So, and I would say you're right, you know, in terms of trying to predict what invasive, especially in the aquatic realm, you know, what they're going to do, it's really tough. It's very complicated, even without the climate change component, and then with climate change on top of that. We know we're going to be drier. We know also that it's going to get hotter. And so maybe in some species that may be helpful. In some, and probably many, it won't be. And they'll be will be more susceptible, more vulnerable to other species getting established in the state. So you bring up a great point. I wish I had more answers.
Yeah. Climate change, it really does have to be factored in with regard to invasiveness. Most of the invasive species we talked about today, you heard, except for zebra mussels, but water hyacinth, giant salvinia, giant ram's horn snails, the apple snails, those typically are tropical, subtropical types of species. So as we get warmer, and this is one of the things that Texans need to realize. You know, we're on the border. We're the conduit with regard to Central America, South America, in terms of a pathway for invasion. So as these temperatures increase, you know, one of the things we didn't talk about today, but really is a concern for me, are the waterborne diseases. The things like malaria, dengue fever, schistosomiasis, and those kinds of things. As we get our water start getting warmer, we're going to be more prone for those tropical types of diseases, especially in the south part of Texas. So, again, that's climate change is a factor in terms of trying to evaluate, you know, what's going to be happening in the next 30 to 40 years as we get warmer temperatures.
I think you're right in terms of risk analyses. It's going to be more and more difficult to determine what species we think may be able to colonize and become established in Texas. That's one reason why I think public education and public vigilance is going to be more and more important, is because some species that couldn't live here before may start showing up. It's going to be extremely important for not just the biologists, but for the public to be cognizant of that and be able to report those species so that action can be taken as quickly as possible.
You know, I'm just going to bring this microphone out to those of you that want to ask questions and to save me from having to repeat it. So I think you were next.
Okay. I'm just curious if you happen to know of all the things you've identified here tonight, the ones that are at the top of your hit list, is there not only methods of controlling, but how many could we actually eradicate, get totally rid of? And on top of that, what would the cost be?
Who wants to tackle that one?
Impossible. Impossible to eradicate almost any of the invasive species just because they're so widespread and they've got so many
different adaptations for perpetuation. Control is the operative word. And with regard to, you know, how much is it going to cost? I mentioned that South Africa study. They've actually done a cost-benefit analysis, and what they've determined is that even though it's expensive in terms of this work for water, I mean, this public, public service types of things, you know, they got 30,000 workers going out controlling invasive species. Sounds like a big expense. The cost-benefit analysis shows that it pays off in terms of water. So controlling invasive species, it's kind of like, you know, any kind of disease. If you look like an invasive species as a disease, it has to be treated by drugs and various kinds of ways. It's going to be expensive. But what I think we need to do for Texas is do a cost-benefit analysis and target and prioritize some of the key invasive species. How much is it going to take to control them? And what are going to be the benefits in terms of, you know, water conservation, economic impacts, and so forth?
I have to say, after years of trying to control these things, I agree with Tom. It's going to be virtually impossible to eradicate some of these species. We can keep them under control. The best chance for eradication, though, in Texas is if we are able to find a species very, very early in a small colony. In some cases, we are able to eradicate it in situations like that. But once the species becomes established, it's going to be very, very difficult to eradicate. Some of these species don't even need a male and a female. They're just clones, and they just reproduce asexually. And if on a 20,000-acre reservoir, let's say, if you miss one plant, then it's still there, and it'll come back. So it's going to be very, very difficult to eradicate some of these things like giant salvinia, but I think we can keep them under control if we're vigilant. Once we get the population down to low levels, we can potentially keep those populations down.
I certainly don't disagree with Tom or Earl. There are some, couple cases just off the top of my head that have been successful. It all goes back to what Earl and Tom were saying, early detection and rapid response. You know, the example I gave in my presentation about the water snowflake, the Nymphoides indica, that we've ascertained the extent of that species on the preserve, found that it covers maybe a little less than half an acre in two different locations, very controllable right now. We've already had land stewardship staff go out, mechanically remove those plants. We've got the locations GPSed in. We'll make another visit in the spring. And then when we draw down those units next summer, we'll take another look at it. And if we need to do more control, we can do it. But we feel we found that. We've ascertained the extent of it, and we're going to control it. Another case regarding cactus moth. I don't know how many folks have heard about the cactus moth. That's a species that is not in Texas right now. We're doing everything we can to keep it out of the state. Cactus moth will obliterate any flat-padded cactus that it runs into, essentially. So you can just imagine, folks familiar with South Texas, you know, even hill country, without prickly pear. Some people, of course, curse prickly pear day in and day out, but it is an important part of the ecosystem, and if you annihilate it, it's certainly going to have some repercussions. So an example that the Mexican government can point to is that it showed up on a little island off of the Yucatan Peninsula called Isla Mujeres, and they found it early. They had monitoring system already set up. They reacted, rapid response, and they mechanically removed all of the host plant material, all the prickly pear from the island, and within 6 months they declared the island was cactus moth free. So you can do it. It all goes back to early detection and rapid response.
That's a great point, Jim, and I want to reinforce with a specific example your question. About this time last year, we got a report at Toledo Bend in East Texas about a 7-mile-long floating mat of water hyacinth and giant salvinia. By the time we were able to secure the appropriate herbicide, mobilize our helicopter spray rig, and we did that in about 36 hours, which for state government is lightning speed, I dare say.
the mat floating vegetation had increased to 16 miles in length, 36 hours, and it cost us $140,000 to treat that in November. So the scale of this is huge, and that's just one outbreak. What else do we have out there in the back? Let me bring the microphone to you.
I'm in the Kerrville area, and I have a specific question about Arundidonex and tallow, because it's really starting to gain hold, and I want to know what are the, because it's along the Guadalupe River, what are the permits or regulations or whatever that we would need to do in order
What species was it?
What species was it again?
Arundidonex.
And Chinese tallow.
Oh, and Chinese tallow? All right. For Arundo, you can. Are you interested in which herbicide to use, or?
Well, what do we need to do in order to do anything to it?
There, because it's a riparian species, the best thing to do is to get to fill out a treatment proposal. It's on our website, and you can look for nuisance aquatic vegetation, but. The treatment proposal is only a fill-in-the-blank, one-page proposal. The district biologist would approve that. If you would like to use an herbicide on Arundo, you can use glyphosate-based herbicides, which would include Rodeo or Aquamaster, Eraser, any of those kind of things, or ones that have imazapyr as the active ingredient. Also, There is a biological control that is loose in Texas now. It's a wasp, and it has destroyed quite a few Arundo plants in the Austin area and the Laredo area. The USDA is also working on a second and a third biological control. So you may want to work with us or with the USDA to try to get those biological controls established here as well. On Chinese tallow. I believe you can use imazapyr on that too. The herbicide would be Habitat, but just in case my memory is misrepresenting it, I would read the label first.
If you'll get with Earl afterwards, just get your name and contact information. We'll have one of our biologists contact you about it.
Yeah.
What else? Anybody else have a question? Yes.
Is that a native wasp?
Wasp. No. That wasp comes from Southern Europe. It has been extensively tested by the USDA. It had to go through a process that included being accepted by both Canada, U.S., and Mexico before it became legal to use. Here, USDA has done all kinds of testing with that wasp, and it looks like it really only eats Arundo. There are some native plants that it'll land on, but it doesn't seem to do much damage. But it will under the right circumstances do significant damage to Arundo.
Thank you. I'm Sandy Pena with the Hill Country Master Naturalist Organization, and one of our major projects is actually identifying and documenting invasive exotics in our four-county area. But I have a sort of a bigger picture question for you. Given how many invasive exotics are already here, how many are coming in, you add to that the problems with global warming coming in, and also a more than doubling of our population in the next 50 years. I'd like to know just how optimistic you are about what the future's going to look like when my grandchildren are taking over. Thanks.
You guys want to? Okay, any Pollyannas up there that want to tackle this one?
Well, as a good friend and colleague used to say, with all that good news, what the girl to do? Does that sound familiar, Carter? Well, I'm an optimist at heart, and you know, and I see some of the victories in the technologies and the science and the brain power that Earl and Tom and their colleagues and so many people that are working on this issue, you know, represent. And yeah, it's daunting. It's like, you know, trying to push hill or sorry, trying to push string uphill sometimes. But you've got to, you know, as the Texas Master Naturalists have done, nobody would have figured Texas Master Naturalist movement would have expanded to the level that it has today. Nobody would have predicted the victory and the movement that's taken place in this state regarding Texas Master Naturalists. So, you know, I am optimistic. I think we can have victories, but we're going to have to be realists too. We have to know how to pick the battles. We know how to invest our time and money into the right places and to the right pick the right battles and do the best we can. And there's other ways, and I should have mentioned this earlier, in terms of how you can really contribute in a big way also, is that there was mentioned by Carter and Earl about the Texas Invasive Plant Council that has representatives from state government for Texas. There's another entity also in the state that was chartered about 2.5 years ago. It's a 501c3. It's called the Texas Invasive Plant and Pest Council. And that is first headed up by Damon Waite, who I'm sure you all know if you're involved in the citizen science work that the Wildflower Center does in Austin for invasive plant tracking. Those are great outlets for getting engaged. Get engaged in the meetings. We have them every 2 years, and they're very productive. We just bring people from all over the state and actually across the country try to get speakers as well to talk about invasive plants and pests, and knowledge and awareness and outreach are keys to the battle.
I'm an ecologist, and that was a good ecological question, and the most common answer to a good ecological question is two words: it depends. and so I would say I'm mixed optimistic. There are some concerns that I have. I'm kind of concerned. I mean, to me, education is a key, one of the key solutions. And you know, we're not doing as good as we could in terms of our educational system, whether it's K-12. Whether it's college, Texas doesn't rank very high in either of those areas. And one of the other issues that's a concern to me that we have to address is this increasingly big disconnect that's occurring between urban and rural. Richard Louv wrote a book a few years ago, and he coined the term nature deficit disorder. And people don't realize Texas is over 85% urban. And we got a generation growing up in an urban environment without any understanding and appreciation of nature and natural resources, ecosystem services, and capital. So that educational thing concerns me. Now, what gives me hope is that we're dealing with a lot of complex questions. And typically, I think back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, if you had a problem, typically one agency could address.